Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Ariana Prale in for Mina Kim. In his new book, The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food, acclaimed chef Marcus Samuelson highlights black chefs and recipes that he says have been underrated and overlooked for far too long. When Americans think of black cuisine, they think soul food, he said, but that is only one of numerous traditions. Samuelson is a regular on Food Network and PBS and operates over a dozen restaurants in the United States and abroad. We'll talk to him about the book, black cooking, and get his thoughts on the dire state of the restaurant industry amid the coronavirus pandemic. That's next, after this news. This is Forum. I'm Ariana Prale in for Mina Kim. Cassava dumplings with callaloo puree, okra and creek seafood stew, braised goat shoulder with locust bean and chili oil. Those are just a few of the dishes featured in Chef Marcus Samuelson's new cookbook, The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food, which introduces readers not only to new recipes, but to black chefs and food experts shaping American food culture. Samuelson himself is a champion of cooking competitions, Top Chef Masters and Chopped All-Stars, a winner of multiple James Beard Foundation Awards for his work as a chef and TV host, and author of the New York Times bestselling memoir titled Yes, Chef. Welcome to Forum, Marcus Samuelson.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
So tell me, what was the genesis for a book like The Rise, which is really a unique kind of project?
Well, I felt it was the time to celebrate Black excellence in food in a way that, you know, gives and honors, respect, and highlights the authorship of Black cooking in America, the incredible influences and benefits that American cuisine have had from Black cooks and chefs through generation, but also set the memory straight. You know, if you don't have their authorship, you can't really have correct memories about it, and you can't build the right aspiration. So a celebration and acknowledgement of what Black chefs, that we're not monolithic, that we have many different, we come from many different point of views, and that's what the book highlights.
So some food media outlets were amongst those that were called out and taken to task this year for their lack of diversity, right? Do you feel like this will be a true turning point for the industry when it comes to inclusion and what culinary traditions it honors? And what do you think a cookbook, or what do you hope a cookbook like The Rise brings to that conversation?
Well, I mean, what, you know, The Rise is something that I worked on for 4 years, right? All my books take 3 to 4 years in the making. So, you know, when we launched a book, we have no idea what to project, what the conversation in American food is going to be on,
right,
48 months later. But this is a subject that I lived, I breathe, and I care about. And so many of my amazing colleagues are African American chefs, writers, photographers, storytellers. And I felt there's 5 original cuisines in American food that stems out of Black cooking: Creole, Low Country, Southern food, Cajun, and barbecue, right? They're all our narratives and rituals out of the African-American experience. And that needed to be highlighted. And that if you don't give that the right authorship, and if you don't have senior leadership in food media of color, you know, chances are that people are not going to call that out. And I do think this year has been a monumental, and books like The Rise as part of that. But I also think because, you know, everything that has happened in major publishing houses, you know, obviously there was a big leadership change in Bon Appetit. We, you know, for us to get John Davis to be in charge is amazing, and to the number two there, Sonia Chopra, which is also an amazing woman and writer and editor. So you know, I know that there's going to be big changes in the content because the leadership has changed.
And why do you think there's been such a silo in terms of recognition of Black cooks and just the diversity of Black food? Has it been because of the gatekeepers with the industry? Has it been a little bit more that maybe there wasn't the proper documentation, like you were saying? Or is it a both and there?
I think it's layered and complicated for many reasons. First of all, I think that, you know, America's history when it comes to Blackness we were never fully written into history, right? And food is no different than that. But our food rituals are old, coming from Africa, coming to the Carolinas and so on, right? But since we were not in leadership, in newspapers and magazines, in mainstream newspapers and magazines, there hasn't been a call out. You know, you look at music has been way ahead of us, sports have been way ahead of us, and now we're going through the same thing in food. Also because I think the way we entered this country through labor, working on the fields and working in, as domestic, adds another layer to this that many other ethnic groups didn't have to think about, you know? But, that has another part of this story. So that makes it, you know, yet another chapter to it. But I'm glad these changes are happening, and they should have happened way before. But I'm also excited by what's happening in present and future, because through social media, there are less gatekeepers. There are more diverse voices, and that's really, really positive for American food.
So for your book, you chose an interesting format for the recipes. They're all, in your words, in honor of a Black chef or food expert that you profile in the book. Why and how did you decide on that particular format?
Well, it was important for me. Like most of my other books, have been about my journey in singular, whether it was Swedish food or whether it was me cooking a Red Rooster or so on, right? This book, I wanted to share the book with these incredible chefs that are out here right now, but also looking back, and also unpack that Blackness can mean many things. Black food could have traveled through the Great Migration, through immigration, and the difference between an Ethiopian American experience and a Jamaican American experience, right? Mm. So we need to understand it both through some multi-layers. Immigration is one great way. The Great Migration is one way. And then also, of course, where you live in the countries. And like Naisha Arrington is Asian American and African American. So her food speaks to that, right? Travell Bristol Joseph is from Guyana, but came out of New York, but lives in Texas. So his food speaks out of that. So, you know, someone like Kwame has both Nigerian and Jamaican roots. So in the book, through the stories, you start to understand the layers and what Black is. Sometimes the word doesn't even cover its incredible beauty and complexity.
You profile, one of the chefs you profile is Leah Chase, who you've mentioned in other interviews as being a significant source of inspiration in your own life. Can you talk about Leah Chase's story and what she meant to you? I mean, she had an incredible life that really seems to epitomize what you were looking to do with this book.
Yeah. I mean, Queen Leah is everything to me. You know, she, just her life starting at the restaurant in the 40s, and the restaurant is still open, Duke Chase, run by her daughter, Stella, right? So being relevant in restaurant business as a family for over 70 years.
And this is in New Orleans, right?
Yeah, New Orleans, exactly. And showing that you can be both female, Black, owner of a business since the 40s. Hello, that's just amazing. But on top of that, also showing she was an advocate and an activist at the same time. You step into her room, her dining room, there were Jacob Lawrence, there were Romare Bearden paintings. So clearly important for her to showcase African-American art. But then also the civil rights movement, a lot of the planning was done in her restaurant. Because for Black people, the word restaurant means very different. It was a place of safety and haven And Leah's restaurant was one of those places. So she gives us so much context to what it means to be a chef and a restaurateur from an era and a time that without the work that they did, that generation, someone like myself wouldn't have a chance to be here.
Yeah, and one of the details that really stood out for me from that story, too, was that she wanted to kind of have a tablecloth kind of dining experience that wasn't happening with a lot of restaurants for Black customers, and to really just give that kind of fine dining experience.
I mean, she was always pushing me to aim higher, Marcus. We have to show there's many different ways to dine. And even at her restaurant at Dookie Chase, Dookie is the name of her husband, her late husband, but the front store of the restaurant was a Provo shop, right? Where you can just pick up your sandwiches, eat quickly and leave, or take them to go. And the back door was the fine dining area that you walked into the restaurant. So she was way ahead of her time in terms of concept, but also her aspirations. She never lowered her aim and her aspirations, you know?
Yeah. And there were, of course, a couple Californians you profile in the book that caught my eye. I think you did mention one before, Chef Naisha Arrington in Los Angeles, who's included in your remix chapter. Can you talk briefly about why you included her and also kind of what that remix chapter represents some more?
I mean, Naisha is just an incredible chef and an incredible person. But I also think in her story, there's so much that we can learn, like the fact that she going to her grandmother in Cape Town, they spoke Korean. Here, a Black woman learning Korean from her grandmother and, you know, both being close to Korean culture, but also African-American culture. So her food draws from several different cultures. And I think it's important to show that we're just not one thing. You know, there's another story of someone like Chef Eric Gistel that has been at Le Bernardin's restaurant, 3-star Michelin in New York, for over 25 years, right? But he married, his wife is Japanese, so he has influences from that. He came from the Caribbean, so he has influences from that. So we are, you know, two people like Eric and Naisha shows how layered and complex our journeys are. And in Eric's case, very much that it's been an anonymous but very important journey that I wanted to share that. All these, being a chef most of the time throughout history, particularly for Black chef, has been an anonymous experience until basically 10 years ago.
We're talking with Marcus Samuelson, chef, television personality, and author, about his latest book, The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food. What questions do you have for Chef Marcus Samuelson? Do you have a favorite Black-owned restaurant or Black chef you want to shout out? Whether they're professional or in your very own home, what do you appreciate about their cooking? What makes it special to you? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. We'll have more with the chef and also get a little bit on his thoughts on the restaurant industry during COVID. That's all next. Stay with us.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Ariana Prale in for Mina Kim. We're talking with Marcus Samuelson, chef, television personality, and author, about his latest book, The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food. His restaurants include Red Rooster, with locations in Harlem, Miami, and London, as well as Ginny's Supper Club, Mark Burger, Marcus Montreal, a number of other restaurants. And he hosts No Passport Required on PBS and has served as a judge on Food Network's Chopped and ABC's The Taste. before we got to the break, we were talking about one of the Californians featured in the book. And there's another one that I wanted to hear from you on, because not every person you feature is a chef. And for example, one of the people you profile is Shakira Simley, who is the director of the Office of Racial Equity for the City and County of San Francisco, who says food is political. Can you talk about including a voice like hers in this book?
Yes. No, man. Chefs very often get in the center of the food conversation, but it's obviously so many people in the industry, people that are our voices, people behind the scene. And I just think Shakira is just one voice that I wanted to highlight, because food advocacy and the work in terms of creating a more equitable table in terms of food, which is politics, which is a big deal, takes many voices. And in the book, you have people like food writer like Jessica Harris, but also Donna Pierce and Tony Tipton Martin. And when Jose and I set out to do the book, it was important that, yes, the majority of these stories are chefs, but there's so many other people in this field that we wouldn't be a part of the industry, couldn't call it out, without people like that have really helped us get the word out on a numerous different platforms and levels.
And kind of speaking in terms of equity, that kind of could segue into looking at kind of what the restaurant industry has been facing during the pandemic. You know, a second stimulus package is finally on its way. I saw that the Independent Restaurant Coalition tweeted this morning a statement that said, in part, this bill falls woefully short of giving 11 million independent restaurant workers the job security they need before the holidays. What does the restaurant industry need in terms of real effective support? I know the coalition has been advocating to support restaurants through the Restaurants Act rather than just PPP loans. What's your perspective on that, also as a restaurant owner yourself?
Well, we don't need loans. We need long-term solutions. The PPP loans are still loans, and to burden restaurant owners and the industry with more loans, that's a short-term solution, not a long-term solution. If you measure it against other countries, that the restaurant gets 85% or 75% or 80% of the revenue back, this is an unprecedented event that has hit the restaurant industry the hardest, right? And we are a collective of 11 to 16 million people, if you call it, think about the bakers and all the delivery ancillary jobs that are within our field. And then think about that in terms of black and brown businesses on top of that. That means that 50, 60% of these restaurants are not going to come back, which means that 30 to 40% of our employers would be unemployed. So if you talk about a pool of 16 million, which is two New York cities, 30%, 40% unemployment, this is unbelievable numbers, big numbers. They're not just going to impact restaurants. It's going to impact all of our communities.
And a lot of beloved restaurants. Go ahead.
No, we need long-term solutions. And most politicians doesn't understand how restaurant works, right? The majority of the restaurants we talk about are mom and pop that are maybe 8 to 12 employees. When they deal, you can see it in the act when they invited restaurateurs in. They invited only majority just chain restaurants. Well, chain restaurants lives a very different life and fast food restaurant than the mom and pop restaurant that very much defines our American neighborhood that we live in.
Right. And that's where we also saw kind of the scandal with Ruth's Chris and being able to, and taking advantage of that. And you mentioned, a lot of the beloved restaurants in neighborhoods have had to close their doors for good. And you started alluding to this, but what do we lose when we lose the independent family-owned restaurants?
Well, you lose your neighborhood, the quality of the neighborhood, why you moved to that place maybe. You lose your barbershop, you lose that nail salon, you lose that coffee shop, that favorite bar. The thing that makes your neighborhood lively and keep the lights on. And sure, we can all order from big boxes and survive. That's not necessarily the quality of life that we signed up for. nor does it create the jobs and create the talking neighborhood, that vibrant neighborhood that maybe you signed up why you moved to Oakland or why you moved to Harlem or why why you moved to Queens, for example, just to mention some.
And what are some structural things you think need to change for the industry to recover and be more equitable to some of the lowest paid workers?
Well, if you think about, I mean, the industry is about to, we have to come out of this hole, which is going to be very difficult. And I do think that the industry will change because of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
We obviously built it in one way. I mean, I can speak my own example. It took me 25 years to build up what we've done. It took 2 weeks to take it all down and convert. We converted Red Rooster, Harlem, and Newark, and Overtown to community kitchens and served over 300,000 meals together with World Central Kitchen. As we opening up, I'm actually in Red Rooster, Miami right now, in Overtown right now.
As and that was a restaurant that was meant to open earlier this year, right? And was that was interrupted.
Open,
that's
closed,
when COVID
open,
came
closed,
down.
Open, closed so many times. And I owe it all to the team that's done an incredible job that stayed with us. But we have to redo our model. That's what we're sitting with right now. Like, we have to start maybe with our takeout as the starting point, because who's to say that this can't happen again? So we have to rethink everything, reevaluate everything, and eventually that will we will reevaluate every aspect of the business. What I take pride in, what a restaurant does in a place like Overtown, a place like Harlem, we hire locally. We create jobs. We've created 90 jobs here in Overtown. There is no other employee that has 90 jobs here. We created 180 jobs at Red Rooster Harlem. On the larger scale, that's not a big, maybe a big operation for a lot of people, but it also creates life and a meaningful center of gravity to that neighborhood where people can meet and greet and a level of normalcy.
Yeah. And the pandemic has also laid bare the many problems with our globalized system of food production and distribution. Do you have any thoughts on that piece of your industry and how to change it for the better?
Well, it's a show by itself. You know,
right.
I have many thoughts on that, but not necessarily linked to the pandemic, but we always have to think about distribution to the neediest in this country. I think the pandemic highlighted it and pulled the curtain away and so highlighted all the issues, not all, but some of the severe problems we have with a big part of America not getting access to healthcare, not getting access to, living food insecure. So there's poverty is obviously at core at this. And when the pandemic happens, it becomes even a bigger issue.
Mm. And you wrote in an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal that you not only believe the restaurant industry will survive, but that it will be better, more connected and led by more diverse voices once it's emerged from the pandemic. I know you've started touching on that a bit, but can you share more of your perspective on that and why you're so hopeful?
I want to lead with hope. It's very important to keep myself going, to keep my team going. And as a leader in leadership, I have to lead with hope, because the negative news is out there every day. But it's also important to come up with solutions. A new entrepreneurial endeavor that creates new jobs. So I do think as we in under a attack under the pandemic and we're trying to figure this out as a collective, we have to also start to see, okay, how can we improve ourselves as an industry? What are the new opportunities that we didn't think about before? Because obviously consumer behavior has already changed. The way you interact today with food through ordering services are very different. And you are not going to go back and change those behaviors completely. Some of these behaviors you're going to keep because they are convenient to you. So how can we keep the good ones and then add the regular restaurants back in more traditional sense when we can go back to the new normal.
Right. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Marcus Samuelson, chef, television personality, and author, about his latest book, The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food. And we're talking with you, our listeners. Do you have questions for Chef Marcus Samuelson? You can give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. And we do have a tweet from Chris who says, I have been binge-watching Chopped, so hearing one of my favorite judges, Marcus Samuelson, on Forum is awesome. So a word from a fan there. And I want to turn back to the book now. You write, if the United States can embrace kimchi and nigiri sushi, we can learn to eat fufu. And say that we ought to unpack why we accept one food but treat another as too different. Can you talk more about that? I really liked the way you framed that.
I mean, the food is coding, right? And food is connected to so many different things. First of all, so much of our food came from Africa but got rerouted to Europe. If you think about chocolate and cocoa beans, right? You think about Belgian chocolate, but the cocoa bean comes from Ghana, right? You think about wine was invented in Egypt, but we think about wine as Californian or something from France, right? And there lies a huge challenge and opportunity in reality. When we send aid to Africa, when we don't buy from Africa in the same way, when we don't tourist in Africa, again, when we just said aid, the pricing of a certain food goes down, an experience goes down, right? For many years, for example, Japanese food was expensive and Chinese food should be cheap. That is all linked to labor laws and how we traded with China versus Japan, for example. And the same thing is done with how we dealt with the continent of Africa and Black excellence. So we think something from, let's say, a Caribbean takeout meal should be super affordable. Why we think that, I don't understand. But we price that at a certain level, a certain box, versus something that comes from another restaurant with a European name to it should be, we accept as more expensive. That's all linked to trading. Of course, in the root of it, slavery, trading, tourism, and immigration. Mm.
We have a comment here from Amanda who writes, two words, Edna Lewis, and giving a shout out to, I guess, her 1972 cookbook on Southern food. I believe Edna Lewis is mentioned at some point in the book.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Can you, for someone like me, too, who is kind of new to that name, can you give us a little education on her?
I mean, we have some, in the beginning of the book, I talk about what we owe to Black women. And Leah Chase, Edna Lewis, Sylvia Woods, Alberta Wright, that owned Jezebel's in New York. And the list goes on and on and on. These were all women, Black women, that led not only the movement, but created a dialogue for Black food. And Edna and Leah and Sylvia Woods are very well known in the industry, but what they did goes way beyond the industry. They should be American household names. And someone like Edna Lewis has opened more doors for now an author like myself, or the author that comes after her, you know, Jessica Harris, Toni Tipton Martin, and the people like Leah, like Edna, that set now the table for, you know, next year, I know at least six of my friends are coming out, Black friends are coming out with cookbooks. That's amazing. But most of that is possible due to the generations like Leah and Edna. Yeah.
And it's just, what also are a couple of kind of the favorite recipes that you enjoyed? I know they're all kind of, it's hard to probably pick one, but are there a few that stand out for you maybe at this particular point in time today?
Well, I love that, you know, my son that was part of, you know, was born 2016 when we started the book and has been part of the whole journey of the rites. And so Zaza's pasta is a Ethiopian dora wat, it's a chicken stew. And then the next day we make this pasta with the rigatoni and a little bit of greens into it. And he doesn't even like eating it. He just like, you know, see how the shape of the pasta changes as we boil it, and then see me tossing the pasta and everything. So he's been part of this book, and it's been one of the blessings during the pandemic to, after a rough day, come home to a four-year-old that just wants to play. So,
and were there any recipes as you were kind of going through the process that really kind of pleasantly surprised you, that was kind of a cool discovery for you?
Well, Yuanda, that was my partner in making the recipes. You know, both, all three, say Yuanda and myself, we have African heritage. Yuanda and Osei from Nigeria, and mine from Ethiopia. And just rediscovering so much from West African food, like the similarities between, let's say, a jollof rice in the book and a jambalaya from New Orleans, for example. There are real links there. We're thinking about grits, and there's an African dish called pap. So just constantly looking at the similarities. And what's been fun about the book too is for me to re-engage with my friends that are across the country, you know, Rodney Scott and Nina Compton and, you know, Eduardo Jordan and Greg Godet, and just these amazing chefs that are, you know, that I wanted to make the book for, truly. And I'm so glad that we can, in this moment, be across the country. And that's also why we mentioned in the book over 200 chefs in the back that we gave the Instagram handle to. So when people say, oh, I don't know any black chefs in my neighborhood, I'm like, it should be impossible to say that, because this is not in New York or San Francisco. Black chefs, great black chefs, are everywhere. You just have to do the research.
We're talking with Marcus Samuelson, chef, television personality, and author, about his latest book, The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food. And if you have any questions for him, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. We're also welcoming you to shout out a favorite black-owned restaurant or black chef that you know of, whether they're professional or in your very own home, what you appreciate about their cooking, what makes it special to you. And we'll have more with Marcus Samuelson after the break. I'm Ariana Prale, in for Mina Kim.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Ariana Prale, in for Mina Kim. And we're talking with Marcus Samuelson, chef, television personality, and author, about his new cookbook, The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food. He's also got a lot of restaurants, which include Red Rooster, with locations in Harlem, Miami, and London, as well as Ginny's Supper Club. He hosts No Passport Required on PBS and has served as a judge on Food Network's Chopped and ABC's The Taste. And we're also welcoming you, our listeners, to join us. You can call us at 866-733-6786 or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. So, Marcus Samuelson, I did want to ask you about the backlash you received for a recipe you created for the book that was inspired by a Haitian soup jumu when it was included in Bon Appetit magazine. Some found your interpretation of the dish to be offensive because soup jumu has such a deep and powerful cultural history tied to Haitian independence. And I know you've apologized for that. And what did you take away from the feedback you received in that whole conversation?
I took away that, first of all, I'm grateful that people are opinionating and guiding, and you can have the best intent in the world, but you can still make mistakes. And in the book, you know, we give it a lot of context. When it went from the book to magazine to social media, that context was taken away. And, you know, that's something that I learned, and I think it's important to acknowledge when I was wrong and when my team was wrong and we made a mistake. But our intent was always to highlight and broadcast. And I have a lot of Haitian friends that guided me through this. Greg Godet was one of them. I spoke to chef of the Haitian Association of Chefs in Haiti. I have a lot of Haitian friends that are not in the food world, but they're very passionate about the food. And I'm learning. I'm going to go to Haiti and cook as well. So I think it's very, like, I'm being Ethiopian. If somebody would misrepresent an Ethiopian dish, it would be the same thing. So I appreciate where I can learn something. You have to own your mistake. I fell in love with Haitian food through my friend Mark Baptiste. And then actually one of the episodes of No Passport Required, we focused on soup jumu and its history. So I felt I'd done a lot of work on that and had a lot of knowledge. And this was something that I was like, this is such an incredible story. So again, I own my mistakes. I own the mistake that we did as a collective. And it's been great to speak to so many from the community and understand what we did wrong.
Yeah. And I know one of the comments on Twitter in response to your apology said in part, this dish is a Haitian independence symbol and is linked to freedom from slavery. Do not alter it. When it comes to cooking and creating recipes, kind of to zoom out a little bit, should there be some sacred cows that are left alone, even in this age of fusion food? What would be your thoughts on that?
I think that the word inspired by, which we used in the book, so much of the food that we do as chefs is inspired by. I have no pretense to know another culture's dish to make it exact, right? And I think that food has a lot of culture meaning. You know, my wife comes from a region where we eat raw beef tartare in a very specific way. If you would not do it that way, it couldn't be called that dish. So I fully understand, and it was something that I've apologized for, and I don't want it to stop our curiosity of food, because that's how we discover, right? I think context is everything. It's like, how do you set it up? How do you set a dish up? And we clearly made a mistake on that this time, and that's something, once again, I've been apologetic for, and I'm also glad that that's the beauty of America, that you have a push and pull, that you have checks and balances. And that means to create a dialogue like that was important and is important. I'm sure it won't be the last time.
We have some comments coming in. A listener writes, thank you for mentioning Rodney Scott. I saw him featured on Chef's Table on Netflix and was blown away by his story. My husband wants to travel to South Carolina just to eat his food when the pandemic is over. How did you decide which stories you put in your book? Must have been hard to narrow it down?
You know, Rodney's story was not hard to narrow down because I adore Rodney. And he, yes, go to South Carolina and eat at his restaurant, and it's worth it. So it's going to be an amazing trip. But The Rise is not a list. There's so many incredible chefs and people that I know that are not in the book that could have easily, would fit the narrative. But it was important to have a broad book showing Africa that we do with Chef Michael, showing you know, this is not just a big city book. Showing stories that are in smaller cities and showing diversity that is not just chefs. So to me, it was very important to have a broader book and show that wherever you are, you can aspire to be part of this. Whether you are a consumer, whether you're a reader, whether you're a chef or a food writer. So that was the most important thing. Show diverse Black stories. There are many Black voices.
All right, well, let's go to a caller. We have Dominique Kren in San Francisco. You're on Forum.
Hi. I just want to say hello. And, you know, first of all, I appreciate your show. Hey, Marcus, what's going on?
Just want How to are you, Dan?
I'm good. And I just want to say that, you know, I think it's important to support several any chef, but especially Black chefs. You know, I have a lot of friends that I know through the years, through all over the world. And thank you so much for shedding a light on this, because this is much needed.
And Dominique,
and also,
I just wanted to say thank you to you. You know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, Dominique came to Harlem to cook with us in Harlem. And she did an amazing dinner, and it's something that my chefs, my cooks still talk about. And you always share your talent. And also congratulations to you, to your memoir, which is absolutely amazing. And you inspire so many chefs around the world with your story. So we thank you for everything that you do, Dominique.
Yeah, but thank you so much for what you're doing. Also, you're quite inspiring. So I just want to say hello and congratulations also with you. And thank you for being on the show. And thank you for giving him a voice, because you are amazing. And I think this world needs more of you out there. And I think the idea is also to understand, you know, that food is a vehicle to communicate to others our story and where we come from, and the voice of those Black chefs are so important to understand what the world is about, you know. And I think it's time, you know, it's been time for a long time, and I'm just so glad that it's happening. So thank you. And can we cook again together?
Yes, I come out to the Bay next time. Okay.
All right. Well, thank you, and
yes,
and happy
for
holiday
calling.
To all of you guys. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
That's beautiful. That was so beautiful.
Oh yeah, nice. Glad we could orchestrate a mini reunion on Forum's air. We have a listener who asks, "What do you think of efforts such as Yelp putting Black-owned business labels or lists? Do you think that makes a difference? Is that the best way to market Black chefs and restaurants?"
I think it's, you know, during this time, Black businesses, as all businesses, but Black business particularly, need all the help it can get, because the access to generational wealth and the access to structural institutional wealth like regular banks are very, very hard for us to get. So if we can get support from different platforms, please, I think it's exactly the type of focus we need at this time. Hopefully, we can get more. We can get back to the table and talk about get access to institutional capital, and it will only happen if there is a real push.
All right, let's go to caller Jared in Santa Barbara. Jared, you're on.
Hi, Chef Samuelson. An absolute honor to hear you, and I want to thank you for being, you know, such an authentic person in this world of celebrity chefdom. My question is, I traveled to New Orleans last year and ate at the chef's restaurant that you mentioned. How much, and I took a cooking class there, how much do you address in your book about the development of flavor that I find much more present in Black cuisine, and how it relates to the accessibility of different ingredients?
Well, I in the book, we talk a lot about the pantry, and the pantry of sometimes new words is awkward to pronounce, but once we get over their hump, we also get all over the awkwardness of taste. And that's a very, very important journey, right? Think how much we learned about each other through food. So I do think that acknowledging food, getting it up to become mainstream, getting us to pronounce things and then articulate it, because then once we do that, we then know what to look for. If you talk about Philae and New Orleans and gumbo, well, if you never heard the word Philae, you don't know what to look for example. If I'll talk to you about a Berbere and Ethiopian Dorowat, well, if you never had Berbere, then you don't know what to look for. So we can't read, we can't discover the nuances of food if we never hear about these terms. The way we learned about wines, you know, we are very clear about, you know, a Pinot, a Malbec, or let's say a Merlot, because we've been learning through so much information, all this information, the different grapes, the terroirs, that coffee, the same thing. An Ethiopian coffee has a very different tonality than a Colombian coffee. So we've done the work on articulating that. It's the same thing with food, definitely food that comes from the continent of Africa.
Great. Well, thank you for that question. Oh, Jared, did you want to follow up?
Well, yeah, it's funny. He mentioned Philae, and I love wine, and I'm in the Central Coast where we grow a lot of great Pinot Noir, and you mentioned Ethiopian coffee, all these things that I just love. But when I went through New Orleans, I was trying to find Philae because here in Santa Barbara, there's no place to get it.
Yep. No, and I'm, and so that's why it's important to get it up to national conversation. And that's why you want to, we want to post things that are so important, because if we don't get outside sort of a just a Southern European or European, Western European palate, then other ethnic foods will always be so different, right? And I think if you look at, I love, for example, how far Korean food, American Korean food have come, and it's unapologetic when, you know, you hear words like gochujang or kimchi and so on. And I love the fact that it's never, that hasn't changed. And it's up to us as food lovers to learn to enjoy it, to mispronounce it, and then eventually to pronounce it right. And then once we do all that, we learn how to appreciate, we get the keys to a new cuisine, which we all are benefited for.
All right. Well, thanks for calling in with your question, Jared. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Chef Marcus Samuelson, television personality and author, as well as chef, about his latest book, The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food. This is Forum. I'm Ariana Prale. We have a few other comments. I just want to shout out RC writes, just want to shout out Tanya Holland of Oakland. She was quite groundbreaking here in the Bay Area.
Nice.
Kate tweets, glad to hear Chef Samuelson educating the culinary community and beyond. Too many Black accomplishments continue to be erased or segregated from the conversation about world food culture. And Grace writes, I would like to give a shout out to a great neighborhood bakery in Oakland, Gregory's Gourmet Bakery, also known as the Underground Baker. Everything is so delicious. Black-owned business, phenomenal human being, generous soul, and amazing smile. Go check out his new mural depicting some of the famous Black chefs and bakers, and also images of his own personal heroes and inspiration, his mom and grandma. So those are really just lovely shout outs to be getting here. And you also include some recipes that are in kind of an honor of your family and in honor of your wife, specifically Maya. And I know you mentioned one of them before around your son. She's also Ethiopian. And in her profile, I thought it was really funny. You share how her family members think what you do is, quote unquote, cute. But you, kind of world famous chef, aren't allowed in the kitchen when she and her sisters are cooking.
I am the fourth best Ethiopian cook in my household. You have to know your place.
Right.
And, you know, if we do a meal in the house, okay, Marcus can do it. But if it's a big holiday, oh, no. They fly in from Toronto, from London, and, you know, move me aside. And sometimes I can chop because I do, like, oh, you can chop fast. So I get some credit for peeling and chopping. But once it comes to putting it together.
Yeah, you're definitely sous chef, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And so what are some of the staple dishes in the Samuelson household around the holidays?
You know, it is gravlax. We definitely do some gravlax with some mustard and some crisp bread and some injera. Tons of Ethiopian food. Dorowat, I mentioned before, and the side dishes around that, lentils. There's something we eat a lot for lunch. It's a chickpea puree called shiro, very simple. And we like to eat a simple lunch because for dinner, we eat more fish, a lot of fish as well, because, you know, it's it's just lighter that way. And right now we're actually all here in Miami at the restaurant, reopening Red Rooster in Novotel, which has been a movie by itself. But we're back, and my son Zion is running around here, and you know, it's growing up in our restaurant.
Yeah, I'm going to try and squeeze in one more caller here, Farah in Santa Barbara. What's your comment, briefly?
Okay. Good morning. Good morning, Chef. I wanted to give a shout out to a Black chef here in town, and her name is Sandra Aduzelli, and she's the owner of Gypsy Hill Bakery, Gypsy with an I, not a Y. And I think it's really important to highlight her work. She comes from England, and she has the most complex flavors, really delicious. And, you know, given the complexities of what people are facing with the coronavirus, I think she's doing a really admirable job with to-go orders. So Santa Barbara typifies white privilege in a lot of ways, and I think your show and the subject of today is really important.
Great. Thanks for shouting that out, Farah. And Chef Samuelson, before we let you go shortly, any advice in general on enjoying food and cooking during these challenging times? I know I'm kind of a reluctant cook, and I've been dabbling more just because there is more time and more time at home. What's some of your advice or recommendations for folks like me?
Well, I think, first of all, cook a lot, cook together. And, you know, something like the rice, whether you're Black or not, I do think that this gives you a chance to talk about race, talk about culture around food in the most delicious way. You know, I would say wherever you are located, buy seasonal, you know, do not, you know, I always say that, like, there is actually at least 12 seasons going on, not four. You know, every month or so, there's something else coming into that market that is just in peak season. Look for those things. Create relationships with your mongers, whether it's your seafood monger or your butcher or your farmer's market, so they tip you off a week before what's coming in, and so you can always eat the freshest and the best in times like this.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Marcus Samuelson, chef, television personality, and author. His latest book is The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food. I hope you have a great holiday, Chef Samuelson, and also happy winter solstice to everybody.
There you go. Thank you so much for having me, and I appreciate you guys so much. It was wonderful to come on, and happy holidays to all of you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. This has been Forum. I'm Ariana Prale. I'll see you tomorrow, or talk to you tomorrow anyway.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.